high today, 17. Winds up to 20 miles per hour. This morning, winds west at 10. 6 degrees in Racine, 8 degrees in Kenosha, wind chill minus 4. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management, a career for the benefit of people, the planet, and profits, from UW Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. Details available at uwp.edu. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy to be spending most of this hour, part one of today's morning show, with Jennifer Sassaman, who is on the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, our neighbors right up the road to the north. And the theater department there, of course, is vibrant and always doing really intriguing things. And a very intriguing musical is the next show on their docket. It is the musical Urinetown. And if you have never seen this musical before, it is really out of the ordinary in just about every respect. And it's an exciting prospect to see. And it is going to open this weekend and run for how many weekends?
It runs for 2 weekends. We have 7 performances over the next 2 weeks.
Very good. So Jennifer Sassaman, we welcome you back to the morning show. You don't look too bleary-eyed, even though this is Tech Week. And you were telling me that thanks to 600 light cues and a lot of other complexities that this is a challenging tech week for you and your crew.
This is a very challenging tech week. Not only do we have more actors cast in the show than anyone who is currently working at Parkside has ever had in a show, but most of those actors play at least 2 parts, if not 3 parts.
Wow.
It is a true ensemble piece, even though there are some notable principal roles in it. Everybody is pretty much singing in every number. They're jumping in and out of costumes. They're helping move scenery. We've got, you know, a bunch of different locations that we jump back and forth. We have a 3-level set. Actually, 4, because we use the trap to create a subway station that people go down into. It's a big, complicated show, but it is a lot of fun.
Wow. I saw it when Carthage did it, and I understand you were there
too,
as well.
Yeah.
You were actually the official sort of critique person to respond to it. And you were mentioning before we went on the air that you actually recently were in a professional production of Urinetown. Tell us about that.
Well, my parents live in Montpelier, Vermont, and so frequently my daughter and I will spend parts of the summer with them, and there's a professional theater company there. So I auditioned for their company. It's called Lost Nation Theater, and so I was cast as Old Ma Strong and worked with a bunch of professional actors. Most of them were cast out of New York City, directed by Sarah Jane Shostak and choreographed by Stephen Dean Moore, 2 really extraordinary artists. The interesting thing about that production is usually this is not a very dance-heavy show, and the choreographer decided to make it an intensely danced show.
Lucky you.
It was kind of like running up and down a flight of stairs for 2 hours every night while singing.
Wow. You were also mentioning before we went on the air that You're in Town is a musical that you were actually hoping and sort of lobbying for Parkside to do a couple of seasons ago, but for some reason it just wasn't in the cards back then.
Yeah, I brought it up. We usually do a musical every other year, so as we were going through the previous cycle of choosing musicals, I mentioned it, and I cannot remember the reason why it was decided that it wasn't a viable show for us that season, and we wound up doing A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which was a great time. And then last year when we were picking seasons, I didn't mention it again because I thought, oh, well, I guess we can't do that show. And our recently retired Lisa Kornetsky said, well, what about You're in Town? And I said, yes, okay, can we please do that one? I would love to do that one.
Wow. So in a nutshell, before we even get to what the show is about and the really out-of-the-box plot that drives it all, even apart from that, what makes you such a champion of this show?
Well, you know, I'm a musical theater person. I've been doing musicals since I was a kid, singer and a dancer. And for me, the most important thing when I fall in love with a musical is always going to be, do I like singing along with it? Mm. So I've been listening to You're in Town for more than 10 years. I can remember when it premiered in New York. I had a friend go to see it, and I sort of recoiled at the name.
Right.
People will think sometimes that it is You're in Town, like you're visiting, you're in town. And then if you see it, it is, nope, urine, as in, you know, urine. Using the bathroom. And I just saw it, and it bothered me. And I was like, oh, I don't want to see a show called You're in Town. And then I wound up, they did it when I was in grad school, and then I realized how ridiculous it was that I recoiled against the title because it's such a great show in terms of the music. It's a really broad spectrum of styles of music. So, you know, if you like Guys and Dolls, there's some stuff that's like Guys and Dolls. If you like Chicago, there's some stuff that's like Chicago. If you like Chorus Line, there's some stuff that's like Chorus Line. If you like Les Mis, there's a whole lot of Les Mis in this show.
So it's almost like a spoof of various musical theater genres, or is that not the right word?
You know, I've been trying to come up with the right word because it's not really a spoof, and it's not really a parody. It's more like it's making fun of and paying homage at the same time. Mm. Like, you can't lovingly joke about theater the way this show does without knowing it incredibly well and loving it. Mm. So
there you go. And it's intriguing that the people responsible for it have not created anything else on Broadway.
They were so good with this show. I want them to make more.
Right. Mark Hallman and Greg Kotis. So tell our listeners, and many of them probably have not seen You're in Town or do not know anything about it, explain the fascinating premise behind it. It's not exactly typical musical theater fare.
Post-apocalyptic musicals are not that common. So the basic premise is that it's 20 years into a really severe drought, and the way that people are handling the water shortage is that they charge money every time someone needs to use the bathroom. So people don't have bathrooms in their houses anymore. They have to go to these public amenities and pay money. And you know, the poor people are, of course, hit the hardest by this. And, you know, the basic idea that you'd have to pay a fee every time you execute a required bodily function. You know, people are suffering. People are trying to get together enough money. And if you don't pay your fee to use the amenities, you are taken to some place that's called Urinetown. The cops grab you and take you away, and they call it exile. But you find out pretty quickly that it's not another place that you're taken to, that they're just controlling people through this police state, and people are getting murdered. So it's a really dark topic. But the interesting thing is you're never allowed to get too serious with the show because the show is constantly making fun of theater conventions themselves. Mm. The play begins with the narrator, who is a cop, Officer Lockstock, and he steps out and he starts addressing the audience, and immediately this precocious little girl, little Sally, comes out and says, "Oh, are you telling the audience about the water shortage?" And he says, "Okay, now, little Sally, let's calm down." And she says, "I guess you don't want to overwhelm them with too much exposition." So, you know, it takes itself very seriously, all the while making fun of the show itself and making fun of theater. So you can never really get caught up in the grief of, or the, you know, like the real struggle that the people are going through, because it's always so absurd.
Right. And in a sense, that's what makes it so perfect, because I don't know too many people who would want to go see a musical, a post-apocalyptic musical that was entirely serious. But when it doesn't take itself too seriously in that respect, it just works. It's incredible.
One of the last lines of the show, again, it's with Lockstock and Little Sally. She says, "I don't think too many people are going to come see this musical, Officer Lockstock." And he says, "What do you mean? Don't you think people want to be told their way of life is unsustainable?"
Probably not, unless there's some infectious songs that go along with it. And as you've already touched on, it's a score that just runs the gamut of
it
various.
It really does.
And in some ways, it's almost a Hamilton before Hamilton in that respect, in terms of there not being one single musical style, but an amalgamation of different styles that somehow work together.
Well, it really reminds me actually of Sondheim's Into the Woods, because I know when Stephen Sondheim wrote that musical, he was trying to use a variety of musical styles, as, you know, each of the different numbers was sort of supposed to reflect something different, not in a parodying way, just to have a more sonically layered obra, I guess. I just used the Spanish word, not the English word.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jennifer Sassaman. She's from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and they are about to mount the musical Urinetown. It's one of the biggest musicals that they have ever mounted in many, many years, actually. And so it is a cast of 19 on the stage of the ComArts Theater, and it is running this weekend and the next. So tell us about some of the challenges that are wrapped up in this show. What makes it difficult to mount, both from sort of a dramatic theatrical point of view and also maybe more technically speaking?
Well, in terms of working with the actors, it's interesting because they have to create a very unique style of performing. They have to say, you know, one of the lines that I had this summer when I was playing Old Ma Strong, there's this big confrontation at the end of Act One, and it's the rich people and the cops versus the poor people who have taken over the amenity. It's very, like, on the barricade, Les Mis moment. Mm. But because the original Broadway cast just had 14 people in it, you know, there's this joke. They keep saying, like, "Officer Lockstock, prepare your man," because he's only got one other cop helping him. And so I had to say, you know, the rich guy who's running it all, Cladwell, says, you know, you're gonna pay. And my character had to say, "He's right, Bobby. They've got two men, and we're all so poor." And, you know, like, there, you can't deliver that in a realistic fashion.
Right.
And yet you have to utterly commit to it in order for the humor to land. Mm. So it's this idea of finding a style of performance that is at once ridiculously over the top and, on the other hand, totally, you know, honest.
Mm.
And, you know, it's been interesting watching these young artists try to work their way to that. So that's definitely been a big challenge. Another big challenge, you know, we just did Forum, and that was the last musical. And I'm lucky enough to be able to be working with Carmen Risi, who is our music director, who was the music director for that show. She's incredibly talented. And there are literally three notes of harmony in Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. Mm. Whereas Urinetown, every song has everybody in it, and not every song, but most songs have the entire cast singing in this really elaborate, at times, you know, seven-part harmonies. And we, you know, I teach the musical theater class at Parkside, but we don't have a musical theater program. So these aren't artists that are being trained on a regular basis on how to handle complex singing. So it's been a lot of work, and they sound exquisite. But it's definitely, you know, with Forum, we could, you know, it's mostly, it's like a group number at the beginning and in the middle and then at the end and then a bunch of solos in between.
Whole different thing. Whole different ballgame.
It is a different game. So that's been something that we have been working very hard on. The set is complicated in that we have to very quickly shift between the public amenity where the poor are to the rich office where Cladwell runs his company, and then we have a secret hideout, and then there are scenes on the street, and it's got to jump sometimes in a dance number through two or three locations.
Wow.
While people are singing. So the set can't be, each individual scene can't be so complicated that it takes, you know, bring the curtain down, spend 20 minutes, bring the curtain up. You know, we can't do what they used to do 100 years ago when you'd have four different acts in four different locations. You know, but it is this extraordinary, because it's the main stage, it's several levels. We have towers and walkways and scaffolding and subway, like trap doors opening up and stuff being flown in. I think that there are no more spaces on our fly rail. I think everything is being used to fly stuff in and out. So scenically, that's a challenge. Costumes, again, I should have. I've never thought to add it up, but we've got the 19 named characters in the show, and then almost everybody plays at least one more part. Some people play two more parts. So we've probably got a good 45 different people to costume.
Wow, different characters.
Different characters to costume.
Wow. And that's the way, it sounds like that's the way the show is designed. I mean,
yep.
The intention is for actors to be playing multiple roles. That's not just something Parkside's doing to cut corners.
No. Again, it was 16 people in the original production. We had 14 this summer, which was a little tight. And being in the show with slightly less than what the cast had called for, I was looking at some of these scenes that are supposed to be these major confrontations and thinking, there need to be more people on stage than this. So I asked for all 19 named characters to be a part of the production. And I was fortunate enough that our Misty Bradford, who's both the department chair and the costume designer for the show, did not pass out. She said, sure, let's do that. Yeah, but it's a challenge. You know, some of these changes happen so fast. And, you know, it's like take off a jacket and put on a lab coat. But still, like, you can't go back to the dressing room to do it. This summer, we were all, you know, people would just be in the wings. The dressers were there to just change us in 5 seconds before we had to run back out on stage.
Wow. Is it specified in the script what doubling occurs, or is that left up to the discretion of the director?
It's not specified in the script, although there is evidence. You know, you can see how the parts have been doubled in the past. But that's one of the great things about having the 19 people, is that there no named characters are doubled. So what I have is, you know, if there need to be some people who are on the UGC staff, UGC standing for You're in Good Company. So if they're on the UGC staff, so we have the named characters of Mrs. Millennium and Dr. Beaulieu and Mr. McQueen and Senator Phipp, but then we have person in lab coat, person in suit, person in lab coat, person in suit. So they are filling out the number as it would have been. But we're not losing any of the named characters.
Wow. How much did your cast know about You're in Town before you undertook this? Is this a show that, by and large, a lot of these young people are already familiar with?
I think it was about half and half. You know, we are fortunate enough to have enough musical theater people in the department right now that not only do we have the 19 people that we cast, but there's another 7 people on our production team who I have worked with, who I know are singers. So, you know, on all levels, the people in this company are musical theater people. And so musical theater people listen to a lot of musicals. So I would say probably about half of the artists knew the show pretty well. I have a theater company in Vermont, and I brought two of our students out to perform with us this summer. So the guy who's playing Lockstock actually saw me in the production, because the cast that I directed Proof last summer, and everybody involved in that production came and saw me in Urinetown while we were in rehearsals. So I knew he was familiar with the show.
Okay, wonderful. So what is it like to be in a professional production so soon before directing it yourself? I mean, have you often had that experience?
I've never had that experience.
And what has that been like? I mean, did you, in a sense, go out of your way to not take too much from that, or the opposite? I mean, has it been helpful to you?
It was extremely helpful for me, because every time, you know, I had to show up in a professional summer stock company. Often you have to show up completely memorized with music and text. So even last spring, while I was getting ready to go to be in the Lost Nation production, every time I worked on it, I was working on two productions at once. So I was the actor doing my work, my research, my prep work, all of that for that production. But then literally anytime I thought about the show or worked on the show, I was having ideas about my production. And I'm not my production in that it's only my show, but the Parkside production versus the Lost Nation production.
Yeah.
And so it felt very efficient. I was always doing a lot of work. There's very little in common between the production I was in last summer and this one, in part because the vision that they had was so dance intensive. There are a few people in our cast that could handle choreography like that, but I mean, this was chorus line level choreography. It was really challenging, and I mean, I was only in a couple of the dance numbers because my character wouldn't do that, but the young people that they cast out of New York City were all like traditional triple threats, really incredibly gifted dancers. And so, you know, the way that that show worked wouldn't have worked with this one. We also did it in a thrust configuration, so the audience was on three sides. And this production is proscenium, so the audience is on one side. You know, it's just, I loved the show I was in. I really had an amazing time, and I have, you know, so much love and respect for my director choreography team. But their version was different from the way I saw the show. So there's very little that is similar between the shows, other than what the text actually calls for. Like Run Freedom Run is a great dance number, but it's usually done where people are running for the end of the number. And the Broadway production did that, and the show this summer did that, and our show did that. In fact, knowing that the actors were going to have to run and sing at the same time, and knowing that I didn't have a cast full of professional dancers, one of the first things I started doing with this cast was begin every rehearsal where we would run for 3 minutes and then sing while
really?
We were running. Yeah, just to get them used to, so it wouldn't sound like, run, freedom, run!
Wow. That's a great idea.
And they sound great now when they run. They're great.
Cool. I want to make sure to give you a chance to acknowledge whoever it is that designed the spectacular sets for this production.
Mm-hmm.
You were showing me photographs. It makes me regret that this is radio, not television, because I wish our listeners could see these amazing sets. I mean, it's just
incredible.
Well,
they can come see the show.
Well, there you go. Right. So who's responsible for these wonderful set designs?
Our scenic designer is a great artist from the Tampa, Florida area. His name is Jared Bray. And we are lucky enough to have him because his twin brother, Jake Bray, is our lighting designer for the show.
Ah.
So we had the idea, or, you know, Jake and Jared talked, and you know, we decided to bring in, or we were able to bring in this outside artist. He's not the only, I think it's a really neat combination because we have two professional artists. Our sound designer and our scenic designer are both out, you know, not Parkside faculty staff. They're professional artists from elsewhere in the country that we have been able to bring in for the production. And we have students who are working on the design team. So it's this great combination of students, faculty staff, and then professional artists all working together. But Jared had a great vision. You know, one of the things that I kept thinking about when I was working on the show was I was just sort of thinking about, a lot of it takes place in the sewers, and it's about, you know, using restrooms. So I just kept thinking about pipes, and I wanted sort of this overlay because there are all these different levels and different scenes. So I knew that I wanted something with pipes and something with levels. And Jared just took that and ran with it. And he had all this great research imagery that had these really big sewer grates and pipes. And the other thing that was really important to me, I've seen some great productions of this where you get the real poverty of the poor. And then, you know, they roll on a desk for Cladwell's office and they're in suits and you're supposed to sort of understand that there's the rich and there's the poor. But I really wanted to highlight this sort of wealth income, this income inequality or the wealth distribution, like how skewed it is, like this tiny, tiny percent of people are profiting from the suffering of the masses. And so it starts out looking like you're kind of in a big industrial, but like decaying industrial dystopian place. And then half the set lifts up and suddenly you're in this bright and airy and breezy and beautiful office. And it's amazing how fast that transformation can happen. Yeah, the combination of scenic and lights on this production, it's just sweepingly beautiful. Even the ugly stuff is so interesting to look at.
Well, and That's a really, really powerful combination, and of course folds right into the themes of the show. Wow, it's exciting to think about all of these aspects of it. So you open on Friday night.
We open on Friday,
and you're going to make it.
Well, I mean the show's going to go on. Yeah, of course. I think that Tech Week is always a difficult time, especially when you've got a lot of different elements to kind of synthesize and get the timing of and still give the actors time to work on their craft. I mean, everybody wants more time, but I'm not remotely worried. It's just work. And the thing that I keep reminding the ensemble is, you know, the way to solve the work is to lean into it, is to stay positive and supportive. I think that people can get exhausted and snippy during Tech Week, and I feel like that doesn't get us anywhere. As long as we're focused on creating in a positive way, you know, spirits are high. People are ready to solve these problems, and they're so. We've had a couple of nights where the crew would watch the show because they can't watch the show once it opens. They're backstage, and you know, once you have people in the audience laughing at what's happening, suddenly the performance gets so much bigger and wider. So, as eager as everybody is to solve the problems, they're also really eager to have people in there and responding to the performances.
Fantastic. So the performances are this weekend and the following weekend.
Yes.
And what is it that people do if they want to get tickets?
So they can go to the Parkside website. If you go to uwp.edu, you can get to the theater department pretty easily. And there's information about all the show times. And there's also a link that will take you to, if you want to buy tickets online, you can, of course, buy tickets in person at the box office at the Rita, which is in the Rita Talent Pickin Regional Performing Arts Center. And there also, you can go to, I believe it's uwparksidetickets.universitytickets.com.
That's right.
If you already know, oh, I'm going and I just want to buy the ticket.
There you go. Well, one way or another, we hope a lot of people will seek out the opportunity to experience in person this very, very intriguing show. Again, you're in town at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and at the helm. Jennifer Sassaman. Jennifer Sassaman, great to talk with you about You're in Town. We wish you and your cast and crew only the best with these next two weekends of performances.
Thank you so much.
Very good. Thanks for being here. 8:38, the time here on WGTD. And part two of today's program is a portion of a conversation that I recorded with a talented author about a very, very interesting book. So here's a portion of that conversation at 8:38. The book at hand for today's morning show is titled Against Our Will, Sexual Trauma in American Art Since 1970. This is a book that explores the many and various ways in which visual art and performance art since the 1970s has sought to grapple with and explore and express to the rest of us and give testimony to the experience of sexual assault, of rape, of incest, of some of the darkest and most disturbing and painful experiences that human beings can suffer. And, of course, also tied up in all of that is the importance of somehow finding strength and resilience and solidarity as one seeks to rise above that, if indeed one has had to suffer such abuse. And the means by which artists have sought to do that, the extent to which in some cases their expressions are part of something that has been a part of their own lives, and the way in which that has been received by the society at large, and the forces against which they were fighting, and the backdrop of the feminist movement itself, all tied up in this really fascinating book, again titled Against Our Will, Sexual Trauma in American Art Since 1970. Its author is Dr. Vivian Green Fried, who is professor of art history at Vanderbilt University. And she is also responsible for Art and Empire, The Politics of Ethnicity in the United States, Capital, 1815 to 1860, and also Art and the Crisis of Marriage, Edward Hopper and Georgia O'Keeffe. This newest book is published by Penn State University Press, and I'm very honored indeed to be able to speak with Professor Vivian Green Fried about her new book. Professor Fried, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg, and I thank you for that very sympathetic and genuinely understanding summary of my book and the issues involved.
I'm curious to know, how long in your own professional life has this particular topic been of interest to you? And I guess part of what is wrapped up in this question is the question of why you are writing this book now. Does it have more to do with, in a sense, where you are and where your interest in this is now? Or is it more a case of because of what has happened and what you're talking about, that this is an important moment to be exploring this in such rich detail?
It's actually both issues. So in terms of the timeliness, in all honesty, when I began writing this book, about 17 years ago, I didn't know how timely it would be, but I had gone to see an exhibition at Western Kentucky University in the beginning of the 21st century by Judy Chicago and her husband Donald Woodman, in which Judy Chicago taught a class with male and female students. The students, once again, tore down a house and created installations repeating the woman house that Judy Chicago and Miriam Shapiro had done in the early 1970s. And I decided, oh, I'm going to go see this installation. I teach Judy Chicago in my classes. I went to see the exhibition, and there were three rooms that captured my attention. One room was the Nightmare Nursery, and the minute I saw that room, although it's called the Nightmare Nursery, I picked up that it was dealing with the subject of incest. It was very powerful to me. And I walked into another space in the major bedroom, in which there was the domestic abuse closet, and that closet had a poster of beautiful women wearing fashionable clothing and eyeglasses, but then the writing on it is saying, he hit me, I really love him, he won't do it again, he tells me he's sorry, and I realized the power of that. I then went into the garage, the rape garage, and the rape garage had voiceovers in which artists were giving their first-person testimonies of having been raped, including a man having been raped by a woman. So I came home and I wrote up what I was thinking about this. And then I went to visit Suzanne Lacy, who created some of the first anti-rape performances, beginning already in 1972. And I met with her. She shared with me her archives. and I began writing the book. I was just going to say, I didn't realize, however, A, how long it would take, and B, how timely it would be when it was finally published.
In other words, at this moment in time, it is especially important for us to be talking about this.
Absolutely. What I say about the Me Too movement is the Me Too movement is actually a continuation of what I address in my book. It started in the 1970s. And the only thing that's different is we now have social media that is forcing everyone to pay attention. And we now have big names in Hollywood and elsewhere who are speaking out and who are taking important people to court, like Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein.
It's interesting because one of the things that is you say in the books, I guess it's in the acknowledgments, you say, by writing this book, I hope to end the silence that so frequently shrouds sexual trauma within American culture. It's kind of interesting to read those words because that used to be true on all kinds of different levels. I mean, there was very thick silence in almost every respect. And now, of course, we're not nearly so silent about this. I mean, not that we are as open about it as we should, nor moving against it as aggressively as we should, but there is not the veil of silence that there once was. What exactly is the silence that you hope you can help end with the publication of this book?
Oh, that's a good question, Greg. I would argue that the silence still exists. So yes, big name Hollywood stars are speaking out about Harvey Weinstein. All of those brave USA Olympic champions went to court and gave their first person testimonies. It was riveting. But someone like Christine Blasey Ford gave her first-person testimony, and she was silenced because although she said what she had to say, it was denied. And I would argue that speaking out still is dangerous, and it depends on the circumstances in which you do speak out. There are some things that might be easier to talk about and some things not. I live on a university campus, and I can tell you that rapes occur on this campus and on every campus in the United States. When I walk into class, a student is not going to say to me, oh, this happened to me last night. I'm not going to hear about it unless somebody comes into my class and is doing really poorly, and I say what's going on, and then they may tell me and they may not tell me. Incest is probably the most secret issue still because people don't want to hear that story and families want to silence the truth and question often if it's a truth. Male-on-male rape is still not discussed. Yes, we're hearing about it in the Catholic Church. Initially, it was about young boys. Now, we're hearing that nuns have been raped. How often are we hearing about adult men being raped? And how often are we hearing about adult men being raped, not by other men in jails, which does happen, unfortunately, but by women, which does happen. And one of my artists in the At Home Project addressed that subject. So on the one hand, it seems as if it's being spoken about. On the other hand, I would argue it still is not welcomed in many places in American culture.
Right. And, of course, just because a story is told, as you pointed out, does not necessarily mean that that story is believed or perhaps even understood.
Right.
And that remains, of course, very much an issue. We're speaking with Professor Vivian Greene-Freed about her new book, Against Our Will, Sexual Trauma in American Art. since 1970. She traces the work of a number of different artists over the course of those decades and traces the ways in which they have sought to give voice to those who have suffered this indignity in their lives. One of the intriguing things you do in your book is to use the word cycle, C-I-C-L-E, the word cycle, to describe certain aspects of the work that has been done. Explain, first of all, how you're using the word cycle, the way in which it is employed in this book, and why you have chosen that term.
When I first began working on the book, I knew I had a theme in which I was charting the beginning of the anti-rape movement during the 1970s into the present. But it was only while I continued doing my research that I realized, wait a minute, these artists from the 1970s, Suzanne Lacy and her collaborators, who did about 9 powerful, complex performances in L.A., their works didn't stop in the 1970s. Their works were discussed and exhibited in exhibitions that took place in the 1980s and beginning of the 1990s, including an exhibition at the Whitney Museum of Art called Rape, and that took place in 1993. And then I realized, well, not only that, but Suzanne Lacy and her collaborators returned to some of the work she created in the 1970s in the first decade of the 21st century, placing the subject of rape within the contemporary context and with a more nuanced understanding of issues related to it. Once I began to realize that, I thought, well, this is interesting because the works that are created in the 1970s are recycled. But then I began to think about the fact that the themes that these founders, I call them the second wave of feminist rape crisis founders, initiated, then gets repeated by other artists into the present day. So I would use the artist Emma Sulkowitz, the renowned mattress girl at Columbia University, who did her performance in order to protest the fact that she accused a fellow student at Columbia University of raping her, and the university found him to be not guilty. She decided to create a performance carrying her mattress around campus, and it exploded. Other students on campus began to carry their mattresses. There were speakouts at Columbia University, but then students at other universities began to do the same thing. So, and Emma Sulkowitz became a poster child. Big article in the New York Times Magazine, lots of press written about her, some condemning her, some applauding her. But at any rate, I would argue that Emma Sulkowitz's performance and her intentions are very similar to what the artist did in the 1970s.
So there's a sense in which works that are separated by decades are still, in a sense, you would say, part of the same cycle of, in a sense, artistic endeavor.
I would say it's a very similar cycle of artistic endeavor. I actually had an opportunity of meeting Emma this weekend. I did a panel discussion at the College Art Association. She was one of the panelists. I met her for the first time, and she commented that she really didn't know about this performance art. So it's not that she was consciously imitating it. It was that she was coming up with a way of creating art, of ending the silence, of asking the viewer to bear witness to her testimony, and for it to enter into public consciousness in the same ways that artists did this beginning in the 1970s. Hmm. And in fact, the earliest work dates from the 1960s, and is done by, of all people, Yoko Ono.
Right. We'll talk about that in just a moment. This was an aspect of her work that I had not heard about until I read your book. Ahead of us digging into some of those specifics, I want to ask you about the way in which this kind of artistic exploration of this is valuable in a way that something, in a sense, more direct would not be. That is, we are talking in this, in your book, we are talking in some cases about visual art and about performance art that at a glance might not be quite as clear a statement as somebody standing up and just giving, in a sense, verbal testimony, or the way in which something might be portrayed on the theatrical stage in a way that is, in a sense, more, not that there isn't a lot of realism in some of this, but clearly there is a way in which you think that when we are in the realm of the artistic, that there are possibilities there that perhaps are not possible in other kinds of more sort of direct and less artistic exploration of this. I don't know if that question makes any sense at all, but I hope you can make sense of it.
Yeah. Well, in my book, I talk about trauma theory, and trauma theorists had argued and still do argue that a trauma, and it can be rape, it can be a war, it could be 9/11. So any kind of extreme experience that causes the characteristics of PTSD, fear, hypervigilance, nightmares, startle reactions, depression, suicidal thoughts, etc., that trauma is so horrible that and so difficult to remember that it is impossible to represent it realistically. And what I found in examining lots of art from the 1970s to the present is that this really is the case, that the artists chose non-traditional media to create their art. Performance art, when performance art was new, it's not anymore, but it was in the 1970s. Video art, at the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, again, a new media back then. Quilts, Faith Ringgold does these quilts, that is not considered to be quote-unquote high art, which she began in the 1970s and continued in the 1980s to create an anti-rape and anti-incest cycle against slavery in Africa on the slave ship, on the plantation, and then the trauma within the African-American family. Some artists do, in the 1980s to today, begin to create paintings, but even if they're figurative, they're abstracted in ways that you really have to look carefully to see what's being represented. In other words, it's so horrible, it's so disturbing, that if you rendered it in a realistic fashion, literally showing a rape scene like you might see in a movie, for example, that's so difficult to watch. You're not going to really, you can only for so long focus. And then you, the viewer, you could be traumatized yourself. You could experience what's called vicarious trauma, but you're not going to be able to sustain that. And I think that these artists worked in these non-traditional media, finding a way in which they could create these performances in which the messages were clear, but not overt in the ways that you, the viewer, couldn't handle it.
Vivian Fried is responsible for this really intriguing book called Against Our Will, Sexual Trauma in American Art Since 1970. And next week, we will be airing this interview in its entirety. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am scheduled to share with you an interview I'm recording later today with Dave Cullen. He is author of the book that is thought of as the definitive account of the shooting in Columbine High School, but his most recent book is called simply Parkland, and it really outlines the extraordinary gun control lobbying effort that has sprung out of the shooting at Parkland High School in Florida. And he tells that story in his remarkable book. On Thursday, you'll be meeting the captains of Carthage College's award-winning mock trial team on the eve of going on to yet another big competition. They've enjoyed great success. We also speak with the director of the program,